by this, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you here this evening to the Dean Lauderdale's lecture in the History of Science, which is sponsored by the Mossman Foundation. I've been introducing these for the last few years, and I knew a little of Lauderdale's, but I found some more information today that I thought I'd read to you. He was an amazing character, and I think sometimes we have these lectures and we're not entirely clear about the people after whom they are named. Born in 1911 in Montreal, Lauderdale attended the prestigious Lower Canada College before entering into McGill's halls in 1928. He graduated with a BA in 1932, followed by a BCL in 35. Yet these degrees, listed on his transcripts, are but a shadow of the riches of McGill life that Lauderdale filled his student days with. Arts, athletics, and accountability would be a most accurate description of Gale's talents. Vice President of the Players Club and Business Manager of the Red and White Review, President of his fraternity, Delta Kappa Epsilon, President, and I wonder if I could just have a little more light here. Is that possible? I shall soldier on. Crew captain of the McGill Rowing Club. Participant in the 1930 British Empire Games. Member of the Athletic Board and president of the Student Executive Council. Well-rounded, certainly, seems to be a very... Oh, isn't that better? Well-rounded certainly seems to be a feeble description. While embarking on the practice of law, Lauderdale was elected Vice President of the Montreal Junior Board of Trade and First Secretary of the McGill Associates. After World War II, in which he served with the Royal Montreal Regiment, and rose to the rank of staff captain with the Canadian Armoured Corps, Gales returned to his association with McGill. Hired as field secretary for the Graduate Society, his mandate was to reorganize and develop alumni branches. About his career, which from law to alumni relations and extracting funds from his fellow graduates, I know some of you experienced that already, and those of you who are students will experience it in the future. Gales claimed, certainly he's not very much more parasitical than law. In any event, I am happier by far now. As executive director of the Alumni Association, Lauderdale sought to link the resources of the many alumni to the needs of the current student body. In this way, he hoped that the variety of life outside essays and exams that he had enjoyed as a student would continue to flourish. And I think we're indebted to the traditions established by people like Lauderdale as we go forward today. Remembering his Ormond experience, Gales was integral in the rebirth of intercollegiate rowing at McGill in the 1970s. For his alumni efforts, Gales was awarded the Graduate Society Gold Medal Award for Distinguished Service on behalf of the university. At the convocation ceremony of 1979, McGill University bestowed on D. Lorne Gales the degree of Doctor of Laws Honoris Causa. So I think that we remember Lauderdale tonight in a very special way in this Mossman lecture, and we're very pleased, of course, to welcome members of his family to pay tribute to him as well. I'd also like to acknowledge tonight the Emeritus Trenholm Director of Libraries, Francis Groen, who is here and has always taken a keen interest in these lectures. I'd like now to introduce to you Professor Nicholas Dew. He is the minder of this function. He takes care of all of the intellectual arrangements in association with this event, and works a great deal to ensure that we have very good experiences on evenings like tonight. Please join with me now in welcoming Nicholas Booth to the podium.
Thank you, Jenny. I'd just like to thank all of you for coming. I'd like to just echo Jenny's words of thanks to a few people. I'd like to thank Bruna Ceccolini for her incredible dedication and hard work in making this event happen on the practical side. I know it's a very busy time of year. I'd like to thank Kimmy Crisworth for her work in designing the poster, and Margaret Carlisle for helping put the poster up around campus. I'd like to thank Professor Tina Piper and the McGill Center for Intellectual Property Policy for lending their enthusiastic support to our idea to invite Professor Jeff Bowie and for helping in publicizing it. And finally, I'd also like to just take an opportunity to thank Janine Schmidt, Fenholm Director of Libraries, for the steadfast support that she's lent to this series of Mosman Lectures over the last 5 years. So it's a great pleasure to welcome to McGill and to Montreal our guest speaker today, Professor Mario Biagioli, who is Professor of the History of Science at Harvard University. Originally from Italy, Professor Biagioli earned his PhD from Berkeley and then moved down to Southern California where he taught for a few years at UCLA, before answering the call from Harvard, moving over to the East Coast in about 1996. The Mario Biagioli's first book, the book which I think really has made him well-known for the first time, was a book called Galileo Courtier, published by the University of Chicago Press in 1993. And this book was, I would say, one of the first books to really show us what it meant to be a practitioner of science in the Baroque culture of early 17th century Italy, which reveals that Galileo's famously checkered career could be understood in terms of the intricate patronage conventions of the princely and papal court. And I can still remember very keenly the excitement with which I seized upon this book as a final year undergrad student at Oxford. As controversial as it was influential, Galileo Courtier is one of those books now which features on the reading lists of every student in history of science and indeed students of early modern history in general. And it's been translated into numerous languages, among them German, Spanish, Portuguese, Greek, but I don't think French or Italian.
No. The Galileo Mafia has blocked the translation.
That is a very detailed study of Galileo's scientific career led Biagioli to focus on questions of intellectual property and scientific authorship and the issues of credibility and trust that surround technological and scientific innovation. It made sense, clearly, to carry this work forward, following the history of these issues up to the present day. And this is what he has done in a long series of articles, along with his Harvard colleague, Peter Galison, who I should mention is coming here in February. He edited the important collection of essays, Scientific Authorship, Credits and Intellectual Property in Science, and he tells me that there are two further edited volumes in the pipeline, one called Making and Unmaking Intellectual Property and another called Worldly Science. In 2006, in a book called Galileo's Instruments of Credit, he revisited the Galileo case in order to explore what we might call the IP issues that surround Galileo's discoveries with the telescope, which we are celebrating the 400th anniversary of this year. He's also been involved in curating exhibitions, including a recent exhibit at Harvard, curated with our very own Mellon postdoctoral fellow Jean-François Gauvin, called Patent Republics, which was on patent models from 19th century America. Professor Biagioli is currently engaged in two book projects, one on intellectual property in science, to be called Scientists' Names and Scientific Claims, the other on the role of environmental imagery in recent intellectual property debates, which is tentatively titled The Author as Vegetable. And it will become clear that it's from this latter project that Professor Biagiorelli's D. Lorne Gale's lecture will be drawn tonight, the title of which is Environmentalism and the Rethinking of Intellectual Property. Ladies and gentlemen, Mario Biagiorelli.
Thank you, Nick, for the very generous introduction. You know, and I must admit that there was a fragment of it that was, a little weird to hear when you said that you had read my book as an undergraduate. So that, time flies. I'm honored to be here to deliver the D. Lorne Gale's lecture. And I would like very much to thank Nick Dew and the History and Philosophy of Science community for the kind invitation. And I also want to thank the Mossman Endowment and Janine Schmidt for making this possible. And last but not least, Bruna Ceccolini, who for having guided me through the maze-like requirements of Canadian bureaucracy and the many forms in the way that only an Italian could. I mean, namely, a person coming from a country that, whose bureaucracy makes the Canadian one disappear. The paper I'm about to present does not fall into a specific recognizable disciplinary genre. It started out as a fairly traditional history of patenting practices by scientists from early modern figures like Galileo and Huygens, who patented everything from water pumps to clocks and scientific instruments to modern geneticists who have patented and continue to patent bacteria. Yes? No, the lights is good. Yeah. Thank you. Who have patented and continue to patent genetically modified bacteria, cancer developing mice, and genetic sequences. But it soon this piece soon deviated from the plan, turning into a discussion of the constitutive role of environmental and agricultural concepts in intellectual property law. The trajectory through which my initial project, turned into this project that I'm discussing here has been far from linear, taking me to topics and places that, as a historian of science, I haven't been before. So it has been an interesting and somewhat quirky ride that I hope you will enjoy as well. So my initial interest was to trace the history of patenting by academic scientists, a trend that has become so widespread and intensely discussed today. But what caught my eye was, as I was doing this research, was the term anti-commons that was used to describe the constraints that were posed not by the patenting of the end results of scientific research, but rather the patenting of research tools. Okay? That is, not the patenting of, say, cancer drugs, but the patenting of oncomouse, that is, a laboratory animal necessary for doing oncological research. So found anywhere between Science Magazine and Science Policy publications by the National Bureau of Economic Research, the term anti-commons end up becoming emblematic of basically the problems that the scientists create for each other when they patent kind of upstream results of scientific research. So parenthetically, the problem of the anti-commons, I think there is sufficient consensus about this. The reason why these anti-commons problems are not as severe as they could be is because, according to a study commissioned by the National Academy of Sciences, most scientists apparently disregard intellectual property. They just simply use whatever patented techniques they need to use. And apparently they are only particularly picky about, instead, sharing materials. So they seem to, by and large, they tend to disregard intellectual property, and instead they are very picky about sharing reagents and cell lines and so on. So conversely, so on the other side of anti-commons, the term like commons and the public domain have become ubiquitous in the literature about the creative arrangements that scientists, but not only scientists, you know, but also musicians, artists, and intellectuals, are developing to counter the constraints that intellectual property poses to their activities. So what struck me was the fact that these terms, the commons and the public domain, were cast in a direct, explicit relationship with images of free green pastures, public lands, and other shared natural resources. And here is an example. So this is the cover of James Boyle, who is one of the proponents, one of the most influential proponents of the commons, the knowledge commons. And this is, the book is published by Yale University Press, but this cover is not produced by their in-house graphic artist. James Boyle had a competition, and this is the one that he picked. So here you see, I don't know if you see it, but effectively we are in a tunnel, okay? And then there is a gate with a copyright sign. So once we are in an enclosure, right? And as we open or perhaps break the gate of copyright, there is no, I think politely, Boyle has avoided to put like a broken lock, because that would be probably create, you know, legal liabilities. On the other side is the public domain and the commons represented as a nice green meadow. So there is, however, a striking contrast between the sense of naturalness associated with these images and the highly technological and infrastructural nature that the commons that the scientists and other cultural producers inhabit. Scenarios that are distinctly not natural. So, for instance, suppose that that green grass there is a knowledge commons. If that knowledge commons was, say, the community of free software, you would have a lot of pieces of paper flying around that is licenses, okay? Licenses that make possible the management of that knowledge commons. So that is, the commons, if you look at the work of Elinor Ostrom, who has received the Nobel Prize for this kind of work about a month ago, the literature of the commons show that they are managed by a lot of norms. For instance, the commons established by the lobstermen in Maine requires very, very intricate rules about who can fish where and how long it takes to become part of the community who is allowed to, you know, to pick lobsters in a certain place. So the literature on commons shows that they are highly social artifacts. They are not meadows. So the tension between natural and artifactual commons would not be problematic if the association between nature and the commons posited in these images would just be metaphorical. It turns out that that's not the case at all, because the logic of property, so both material property and intellectual property, posits a dichotomy between nature and an artifact, nature and society, and attaches property rights only to new humanly made artifacts. So, for instance, in the case of copyright, if you take a photo of a landscape, of course you don't own the landscape. So you have intellectual property right on the way that you have framed the picture, that is, on the personal expression that you have contributed to the making of the image, right? What the property is attached to is what you have contributed, not what nature has provided. Similarly, in patent law, you can patent inventions, things that you have produced. You cannot patent products of nature. So nature is opposite to property. This microphone is falling down. one of the features is that I have an unusually large head. I have an XXL helmet for my bike. So it makes sense, therefore, that the critics of IP would gravitate toward the nature pole of this equation, precisely because they are critic of IP. So it makes sense for them to represent the commons as natural, because that's what—that's the direction in which they want to move. So James Boyle, for instance, frames his proposal, which he calls cultural environmentalism, that is what I'm talking about, as, quote, the opposite of IP. And you see how this cover matches his argument. So I strongly support the general political stance of this movement, the cultural environmentalism movement. It has created a huge momentum in support of initiatives that try to keep knowledge and culture as accessible and public as possible, and has become, at this point, a staple of the culture of young intellectuals and artists. Also, these people have a sense of humor, which does not hurt. This is a comic book designed by two law professors. And actually, it's not as bad as it sounds. So here it's an independent filmmaker that by day she's a filmmaker and by night she fights for fair use. And this, if you look at the top, you know, it's Tales from the Public Domain. And this is, again, it's a book that James Boyle and Keith Aoki put together. So at the same time, I believe that the naturalistic images of the commons and the public domain that are invoked to exemplify the collaborative nature of knowledge production are actually part of the very problem they try to solve. That is, while concepts of the commons and the public domain are mobilized as critiques of intellectual property and as remedies of the so-called anti-commons, they end up reifying the crucial binary opposition that intellectual property establishes between nature and society, discovery and invention. As it will become clear in the rest of this paper, if this microphone lets me finish the paper, I think that such a dichotomy is something we need to rethink if we want to turn intellectual property law into something that can sustain rather than hinder innovation. So I want to trace a little bit the logic of this movement, this cultural environmentalism movement. So the main argument of this movement is that if in the past the public domain appeared sufficiently large, healthy, to support the production of more innovation and more intellectual property in all fields, it is now shrinking fast as a result of the second enclosure movement that fences off not land but intangible intellectual property. So keep in mind the cover of the book with the tunnel with the gate at the end. That's the fencing. So the problem, they say, is not so much with privatization per se. So these critics, these are not radical critics saying intellectual property is bad. They're just saying there has been too much fencing of the public domain to the point that the public domain has shrunk, and by shrinking, it cannot sustain the development of more intellectual property. Okay. So this is an argument like sustainable development, in effect. So a lot of privatization now may mean less property production later on, and this will affect everybody, both the struggling artists as well as the big corporations. So again, the tone of cultural environmentalism is not openly critical. Now, the other thing that they do is that they try to argue that in the past, the public domain was treated as, if you want, a leftover, the kind of things that would come off patents when patents expire or when copyright terms expire. Now instead, so it would be effectively a negative connotation of the public domain. Instead now it is presented as that which sustains and feeds the growth of intellectual property. So this came, the movement started out in the early 80s. David Lang, who's now in the law school at Duke, he was the first one to establish this kind of environmental analogy, which I will not read. I'll just leave it up there. But I think that the bottom quote is pretty interesting. The field of intellectual property law at large sometimes seems to be beyond the possibility of exhaustion. But then that was the view taken by the public toward the buffalo as they were being hunted down 100 years ago. And where are the buffalo now? Apparently, he has rewritten this article taking out the line about the buffalo. He's apparently embarrassed about it. But cultural environmentalism has effectively turned upside down the famous image of the tragedy of commons that was put forward by Hardin in his 1968 article, where he argued that if you have a common resource without restriction, say a common pasture, the herders would put as much as many animals that they can on the pasture, therefore depleting it. So the only way to avoid the depletion of private resources was actually to make them private, so that there would be an incentive to maintain them. So cultural environmentalism instead casts the public domain as being dangerously depleted rather than saved by intellectual property. So it's a perfectly complementary argument to the one that Hardin had developed. Now, what are the problems of this trend? So natural images seem to work very well for cultural environmentalists, but some serious and intriguing problems follow from the fact that these images of nature and of the environment and more generally of organic growth have always been involved in creation narratives of about property, especially intangible intellectual property. So the cultural environmentalists do not seem to be aware of the extent to which, in a sense, they are repeating the story. So they are not aware of the extent to which their environmental metaphor may be, in fact, reifying rather than questioning the logic of intellectual property. So starting with Locke, the creation of private property was presented as the result of applying labor to something in the state of nature, either land or other natural resources. Analogously, the proponents of copyright law in 18th century Britain took land as the paradigm of property. Now, it makes sense. People say, "Well, look, there were not a lot of forms of property around then. So, if you are trying to introduce a new kind of property, it's pretty natural that you would, analogize it to land." So, this argument is right, but there is something that has been missed. That is, the analogies between literary property and land were articulated well beyond issues of title and property. That is, the proponents of intellectual property in the 18th century looked at land not just as an image of property, like, I own my intellectual property in the same way that I own my field, but they looked at land as a site of production. Okay. So things grew from the land, and the establishment of literary property hinged not on so much on blunt analogies between land and texts, but rather on the development of the discourse about the production of literary works. And the literary works that can be protected by copyright are original literary works. So the land, I argue, became, and not only the land, but the things that grow on the land, like plant, become, if you want, images to think through in order to understand how originality could develop. So land is not just an image of what it meant to hold property, but it's an image to narrate the way in which one can make literary property. So, for instance, originality and imitation, not just property, could be translated into land-based images by comparing imitators to renters. So I'm not going to read you these long quotes. I'm just going to put them up there. These quotes are from... They are spread over about 60 years, basically 18th century debates about literary property. So they are kind of, some of them are early, some of them are later, but they come all from that context. Literary production was described as, quote, a mental harvest, an analogy that could be also used to discuss the nature of individual creativity. Quote, the mind of a man of genius is a fertile and pleasant field, end of quote. Or, as another author put it, quote, his brain, which was his estate, had as regular and different produce as other man's land, end of quote. Along the same lines, different kind of soil or cultivation could be used to distinguish between natural and or innate genius and instead genius that was the result of training. So, for instance, in this period, people were referring to Shakespeare as basically an ignorant genius. So the genius of Shakespeare was like wild plants, and it's discussed in this quote that I put put there. So in 1774, this was a landmark case, the Donaldson v. Beckett case. These images were mobilized once again on behalf of the London booksellers, who were the one pushing for intellectual property. Quote, in this various world, different men are born to different fortunes. One inherits a portion of land, he cultivates it with care, it produces him corn and fruits and wool. Another possesses a fruitful mind, teeming with ideas of every kind. He bestows his labor in cultivating that. The produce is reason, sentiment, and philosophy. So these quotes can be multiplied, but I don't want to bore you with those. But I think that they establish that from the point of view of a 17th century proponent of literary property, what modern cultural environmentalism is doing is effectively rediscovering the wheel. Or, if you want, you know, maybe it could be something like the return of the repressed, the vegetable repressed. So the cultural environmentalism is caught in the same discourse it is trying to question, finds confirmation in the fact that it stereotypes the commons in the way that Hardin does. So they stereotype the commons in the same way that their adversary does. So Hardin misrepresented the commons as natural, and Hardin basically ignored all the evidence that sociologists and economists had piled up about the fact that commons actually are infrastructural. There is a lot of norms attached to them. So he turned them into natural, ignoring the evidence about the fact that they were not natural, to argue that only privatization could save the commons from their doom. The cultural environmentalist, too, naturalize the commons in the sense that they do so, but they do so to put forward an idealized image of fruitful, collaborative knowledge production happily thriving outside of the constraints of privatization. So again, you have both camps end up naturalizing the commons for completely different reason. The second part of the paper is substantially different. So up until here, I've shown how the nature-society divide is implicated through environmental and agricultural images with the very logic of intellectual property. These images are brought in to show how things, original things, grow and therefore can become the object of intellectual property. In the rest of the paper, I want to show that these images, specifically the images of plants, undermine the very dichotomy that they're asked to buttress. That is, an understanding of the full range of plant metaphors may point to a way of rethinking intellectual property beyond its current logic. Or another way to put it is that cultural environmentalists like James Boyle may be right, but for the wrong reasons. So this part of my argument requires to go back about two centuries and a half to a text that is seen by historians of copyright as the birthplace, or at least one of the birthplaces, of the modern notion of the author. So starting with Martha Woodmansee's 1984 article on genius and copyright, the historiography of copyright has established that the fundamental legal concept of the author's original personal expression was developed in the late 18th century by drawing on the notion of genius, specifically romantic genius. I do not have time to trace all the story, but I'm happy to go back to it in the question period. But the main ingredients is a text written by Edward Young in England in 1759, translated immediately in Germany, picked up by Fichte. Fichte produced the most sophisticated philosophical description of personal expression. That text became seminal in the establishment of German copyright law, and it was then translated back into British and American copyright law. And the notion of personal expression is still the core, I think the core of modern copyright law. So, in early modern legal fiction, genius managed to achieve a crucial double effect, or some people would say a double trick, to cast an original composition as a uniquely original artifact, different from any other composition. And in doing so, in a way to minimize the visibility of what the author had actually borrowed from others. So the image of the flash of genius recasts the production of a work as something instantaneous, erasing the traces of the many hours spent reading, borrowing, and drafting. So that's one of the tricks. So it's not just the flash of genius, meaning a flash of creating power. It's the fact that we're talking about a flash. So is the extreme brevity of the flash that literally erases the long, the process through which a work would be produced. And if instead you could follow the production of a literary work, you would realize how much the author had borrowed from others. This notion of the relationship between romantic genius and the construction of the author, the romantic author, as the birthplace of copyright and all the problems that the critics of copyright find with it, is now quite standard, and it's completely endorsed by the cultural environmentalists. So effectively, I'm talking about a concept that is central to James Boyle and his colleagues. So Martha Woodmansee traced the origin of the romantic author to Edward Young's 1759 Conjectures on Original Composition. Now, and here things start getting weird. An original, by which he means an original composition, may be said of a vegetable nature. It rises spontaneously from the vital root of genius. It grows. It is not made. Imitations are often a sort of manufactures wrought up by those mechanics, art and labor, out of pre-existent materials, not their own. Okay? So what's interesting is that Young represents genius as a plant. So the title of the working title of the book, The Author as Vegetable, is actually descriptive. So Young's representation of an original composition as a plant and elsewhere as a flower is contiguous but far from identical to traditional images of literary property and land that I presented before. all or most of the metaphors, metaphorical associations between literary and landed property had the fairly simple goal to legitimize the new notion of literary property by establishing a direct analogy between these two forms of property. Now, those analogies assumed and reiterated that literary works and human author and ahead human authors who could be analogized to the landowners or the farmer who cultivated that land. Okay, so all the images that I've showed you, all these quotes, is that there is land, that there is literature growing in these fields, but it grows because it is cultivated. It grows from a land that is owned by the author and cultivated by the author. Instead, Young's text is more ambitious. It tries to capture in images the process through which an original composition and subsequently literary property may be produced. In doing so, and this is the crucial point, Young ends up representing the emergence of an original work as a process of vegetable growth rather than the result of human imagination. Okay, so the human is dropping out of the picture. So Young's genius is neither the owner of the field in which original composition grows, nor the farmer that cultivates it, nor the method of cultivation. Genius is part of the plant itself. This epitomizes Young's overall argument. Genius always belongs to nature, never to art. So this allows Young to cast genius not only as vegetable, but also as external to consciousness. In a sense, genius is not, technically, is not even human. Right? So genius is not conscious of itself in the same way that an oyster does not know that it holds a pearl, or a rock, here. So the oyster is not aware of containing a pearl, and a rock does not know that it contains a diamond. So, not only original composition grows naturally, but the author is not even aware that it's growing. Okay. So, as a result, and this is, where the connections with copyright law become, I think, a little bit more clear. As a result, genius can absorb other works through its roots, because it's a plant. But such absorption does not at all imply influence from other authors, because the plant is not aware of what it sucks up. Okay. So a plant can absorb other people's work without being aware of it. Okay. So the plant absorbs culture as nature. Okay. You know. If you want, the roots of the plant, of the genius plant, are a culture laundering device. So originality stems only, and you understand that in copyright, this is important because you limit the borrowing from other works, and therefore you maximize the intellectual property. So originality stems only from the variability and copiousness of nature, not from the rules of craft. And here it's interesting. Young says, "No two faces, no two minds are just alike, but all bear nature's evident mark of separation on them." So this is another interesting analogy. The original composition is like a face. Okay, I take Young discursive acrobatics to be a sign of the predicament faced by anyone who wants to defend copyright and mutatis mutandis patents by defining creativity and invention. That is, as Young struggles to come up with a notion of originality, which he needs to do in order to legitimize intellectual property, an image that could both demarcate authorial artifacts from nature while also distinguishing the artifacts of an author from the artifacts of another author, he turned genius in a plant. So his discursive choices may be surprising, but certainly they're not accidental. Like personal expression today in copyright law, Young does not articulate an argument based on the ecstatic qualities of an original composition. He's not saying you author deserve copyright because your work is good. He's simply saying you deserve copyright because this work comes from you. Okay, so it's not an argument about quality, it's an argument about originality in the sense that you are the point of origin of the work. So, at one level, he's comparing genius to a plant or to a face is a very apt move because organisms of the same species never look the same. Okay, so the argument, so the choice of plant is important because, you know, if you have, say, two tomato plants coming out of the same bag of seeds, you're going to get two different plants. They're the same species, same variety, but they're going to be different. Okay, so that's what's interesting. Any composition that comes out of something that behaves like a plant is bound to be different. So Young's discussion of genius draws an interesting analogy between the uniqueness of plants and human faces. This is an analogy that actually emerges in other texts from this debate. So the 1774 piece by Francis Hargreaves, Argument in Defense of Literary Property, makes the same argument. Okay, so why is the face important? So interestingly, both Young and Hargreaves present the face as human, and yet that image does not establish a connection between humanity, genius, and originality. That is, the face may be the face of a human, but it's not produced by that human. Okay, so the face is not unique. The face is unique because it is the product of nature, not the product of the person whose body it is, whose body that face belongs to. Okay, so the topos of the face is functionally analogous to the topos of the plant. Originality can only be a product of nature, not a human artifact. So if you want, both the face and the original literary work emerge with or through the author, but is not produced by the author. So to wrap up, while Young saves genius by casting it as a vegetable, it also kills it with and during the same move. He saves genius as a vegetable or a natural face, but the logic of copyright would require Young to do exactly the opposite. That is, the logic of copyright would want genius to be human, because the way you produce property, both tangible and intangible, is through the human intervention on nature. Okay, so this is the paradox. This is what Young is doing effectively, is like rewriting the quote that I just that I put up earlier about Locke, where Locke says, "Your property is derived by you have a person who owns his body, puts the labor, mixes the labor with nature and produces property." Okay, so that's the canonical image of the production of property. What Young is saying is that it would be like, well, property is born, is not made. Okay, so it would be exactly the opposite of the picture proposed by Locke. So the kind of genius needed to actually justify intellectual property would have to be the exemplar of artifactuality, not nature. Okay, so a kind of authorial agency that would be able to move something from the side of nature into the side of society or of artifacts. So this is, to me, quite interesting. That is, Young comes up with what I take to be the best theorization of originality, except that if you look at it after going through it, is exactly the opposite of what he should have done to to legitimize intellectual property. For those of you who do not hate Derrida, I think that this is an aporia. So, conclusions. There is no reason to assume that modern intellectual property doctrine has been cured of these constitutive paradoxes found in Young's concept of genius. By the way, Fichte elaboration of what Young does is actually weirder. Anyway, I'm happy to say something about that later. So, to the contrary, a deconstructive reading of Young's text, as I've tried to present, and by extension of the discourse of cultural environmentalism and the public domain and the commons, shows that dichotomies between nature and society, discovery and invention, or idea and expression, are and have always been inherently unstable. And to me, this is a good thing, because it opens up the possibility of rethinking intellectual property in other ways. So unthinking these dichotomies would put us in a virtually uncharted territory. Literally, what I proposed is just was a critical reading of Young. You know, I haven't really proposed anything. You know, therefore, let's rethink about intellectual property in this way. I don't know what this way would be. Okay, but luckily, there are a few slips that the law makes here and there, slips that we can use as starting point to rethink about intellectual property. So the funny thing is that some of these slips that I'm going to describe very, very briefly concern the IP protection of those things that actually are at the center of Young's argument, that is, plant patents. Okay. So I think that is actually is not accidental. Okay. For instance, in both the U.S. Plant Patent Act of 1930, which concerned asexually reproduced plants. So these are plants that you cut a branch and then you graft it on the trunk of another plant. And the International Convention for the Protection of New Varieties of Plant, called UPOV, of 1961, that is originated in Europe and now it's international, which concerned also sexually reproducible plants, we find that the breeder is not required to disclose the ways in which she has produced the plant variety that she wants to protect. Okay. So what replaces is, in patent law, if you apply for a patent, you need to write down how, not only what you want to patent, but also how you have produced it. So you have basically to write down your inventive step, okay? Basically the way how you have produced that artifact. So in these two laws, one American and one international, there is no specification requirements. People do not write down how they have produced the plant. What they do is that they give you a picture of the plant. Okay. Now, this looks like a small thing, but effectively what it means is that the inventor is not describing an invention, he's describing a discovery. And in fact, it gives you the picture of the discovery, because there is no narrative about the invention, right? So this means quite unequivocally, I think, that in these cases, the crucial distinction between invention and discovery has been effectively dismissed. I mean, people don't comment on this, but you know, these examples, I think, are quite clear. In turn, this acknowledges that the inventive step, that is, that produces an artifact we call invention, is not the result of human agency alone. If what creates the patent or the breeder's right is the distinctiveness of the variety rather than how this distinctiveness was brought about, then it does not matter whether the production of that variety should be credited to nature's random mutations or to the breeder's selective interventions. In fact, UPOV bypasses discussions of the nature of the inventive step altogether, limiting itself to defining breeder as, quote, a person who bred or discovered. Okay, so the breeder, that is the one who's going to get the patent, is a person who bred or discovered or developed a variety. Okay. Similarly, the U.S. Patent Plant Act states that, quote, Whoever invents or discovers and asexually reproduces any distinct and new variety of plant may obtain a patent for that. So the breeder has to be human in order to apply for a breeder's right. Right? I mean, plants don't go to the patent office. But there is no pretense in these two laws. There is no pretense that what she may gain protection for was ever the exclusive product of human inventiveness. The varieties protected by modern patent law are certainly not Young's vegetable geniuses, but they still end up destabilizing the notion of authorship and inventorship conceived in strictly human terms. Now, these are only a few examples. Another one that is slightly less fitting is the geographical indicators like Parmesan cheese, champagne, basmati rice, if it passes. So these are names, they're brands, but the things that are protected through the geographical indicators are explicitly presented as products that share the features of the terroir, that is, the local nature, and the technique of humans. So these are this is a form of intellectual property protection where human agency and non and natural agencies are recognized. Thus, one more example of the breakdown of the nature-society divide in traditional patent law. So these are only a few examples, but hopefully sufficient to point to the fact that the nature-society dichotomy and the figure of the exclusively human author has already broken down, not in the text of the critics, but in the law itself. So, and that therefore the plants may be much wilder than the cultural environmentalists take them to be. So paraphrasing Bruno Latour, I would say that if we want to rethink intellectual property, we should try to come up with a notion of cultural environmentalism that does not reify the nature-society divide, a divide that, as Plant show us, was never robust to begin with. Thank you. So the Aristotelian form and matter dichotomy is actually very much in action here, and it continues to remain crucial to intellectual property thinking well into the 19th century, where, for instance, you know, machines that produce, you know, like mechanically produced products are seen as the machine gives the form to the product. And the machine is, suppose that the machine is a patented invention. So there is often a tendency to see that which is patented as the form in very much Aristotelian terms. Now, in the case of Young, the reason why his work was highly influential in Germany is because he was seen as a romantic. You know, he's he was famous because of his night thoughts. Work that was immediately translated in Germany and really fueled the German romanticism. So he's seen as, you know, a romantic fellow traveler from far away. So his work is seen by the German romantics as very fitting. And so, and especially, so his work, the work that I've cited, the original composition, had two German translations in less than 1 year from the English publication. So what Fichte does, he picks up the notion of the genius. the notion of the plant, he doesn't mention the plant, but Fichte's notion of personal expression is a very peculiar one. He basically says that we, as natural individuals, not as the result of nurture, okay, but we are innately, we all think differently, okay. So whatever we do, but also whatever we read, we transform it to make it fit our personal expression. So personal expression in copyright law is more about, is seen as the form that produces the work. According to Fichte, it is that, but it also works in reverse when we read somebody else's work. So the bizarre thing is that precisely because we are all different, because we are naturally different, not as a result of cultural differences, because we are naturally different, we cannot plagiarize each other. Because if I read your work, I will change it. That is, I cannot not change it because I am naturally different from you. So the bizarre notion of infringement that Fichte comes up with is that, so we cannot infringe each other's copyright except there are the printers who are printing our books without paying us. So he sees infringement by the printers as a violation of our usufruct. So nobody can take our intellectual property away from us. But those bastards, the printers, can print books, which is not, in his view, is not plagiarism, because they can't take our personal expression away from us. Right. So it is a bizarre, but you see that his insistence on the fact that we cannot plagiarize each other because we all have this personal expression, it's because he attaches it to nature, not to society, because if that was the result of society, we wouldn't be that different, because we actually be closer to each other because we belong to the same culture. So so that's the part where he lifts the naturality of personal expression straight out of Jung, and then it became the law.
But the printers can take the things that you're
doing. Yes. So the printers, they cannot steal your property, but they can take the fruits of your labor. Yes.
We have two more questions. Andrew?
I wanted to follow up on this idea of the romantic appropriation job. You see it in the literature all the time. Jung is not a romantic. He's writing in 1759. He just belongs to a very different cultural moment, and I think that might help explain why his work is an intellectual property theorist. I think part of the Fourierists you're talking about have to do with Jung's project. He's not an intellectual property because he's thinking for the vegetable because it's a mode of feeling and not a mode of ownership and possession and all those other things, right? That he's thinking of putting feeling into art, and how can feeling be a mode of creativity and therefore a new way of having works of art in common that are tied to personal expression, personal feeling, and not, say, poorly assimilation in later within early modern context. So that the question is for Jung, I think, is when you put this idea of feeling and organic into the equation, you get a new way, not of ownership, but of actually commonality. That sentimental project of sympathy, of jointness. And I ask this in a way of thinking, how might this give us some ideas of the kind of alternative property models you're thinking? And it might actually be very useful for that, because there's a kind of sharedness
before. Well, you know, he has some really... So first of all, I have read this text, and I've traced, read his letters to see exactly how much it was connected to the intellectual property debate, because effectively he's seen as having had this big effect, but via Germany.
Yeah.
Okay, not so much in Britain at the time. So the two bits that I found is that he was actually a victim of plagiarism. So there is a deposition that I found, but I haven't read yet. There is a deposition by Jung that predates by about 10 years the original composition text. And in the original composition text, he does say, there's one line that says, property is the mark of authorship. Okay, but that's all he says. So, you know, it's not that he fleshes out the relationship between the author as vegetable, the genius as plant, and literary property. That's done by Fichte and then reimported to England via Wordsworth. At least that's the story that historians of copyright. So the thing about feeling, I don't know, and it sounds like you know more about Young than I do. What he has some seriously weird passages. Like, for instance, he says that if you copy the work, then you what comes out is not original. Okay, if you copy the person, then what you produce is original. And he says, if you could put yourself in Homer's shoes, okay, so if you went, basically, if you were born where Homer was born, if you went through, you know, basically, if you became Homer, you would do exactly what he produced. And he has this kind of geographical determinism. He talks about, culture in terms of weather. So he doesn't talk about patronage as cultural influence or reading other people's work as influence. He basically says patronage is like water and sun. You need it to let the plant of genius grow. So everything is naturalized, not only the internal engine of creativity, but also the other things that the author picks up. That's what I meant by, the culture is laundered into nature. He does that all along, and his crucial point. So, feeling. I'm not sure. I don't know how to, answer your suggestion. What I've seen is this distinction: if you copy the work, you are going to produce copies. If you copy the person, you are going to be original. Because the person is original, because the person is nature. Right, that's the.
Yes, I have a few concerns. The first one would be that I don't think there is a sort of 18th century vision of copyright. I think there is a very conflictual field which has been partially delineated by, for example, Mark Rose in his Authors and Owners.
Yes.
Where absolutism of the king is attacking property, absolute property, and so on. And that I think, would call for distinguishing the kind of metaphors each side would bring about. And that I'm not sure you would find the same kinds of metaphors on both sides. On the side of genius, I mean, the first battle is between absolutism and property is on the side of the stationers and printers. On the side of authors, who generally side with the printers for obvious reasons, they have an extra problem, which is to essentially bring about a kind of, class status of some sort, the authorship. And the notion of genius, which starts sprouting up all over Europe, in France as well as in Britain and the rest of the continent, seems to me to be the very amusing attempt, in a way, to produce an equivalent of the feudal system of noble blood.
Mm-hmm.
Since you don't have noble blood, you're going to have noble mind. Genius is going to be the guarantee of the noble mind. And if you are a noble mind, you're no longer a mechanic and you're not cobbling up things. What you're doing is transmuting, doing incredibly different things. And that's going to reflect itself later on into the moral rights of the continental doctrine of authors' rights. Now, what's interesting is that after the battles in Britain that stabilized with the famous court decision around 74, I believe, with the Lord's Chamber, the Chamber of Lords, whatever the name is in Britain, then you have the Americans coming in. And that brings back to your initial question. Then the whole issue then is completely transformed. Because at that point, what you have is thinking no longer in terms of creating protections for various categories of people, but creating an equilibrium, that was your original metaphor, between how can you produce using what's before, and at the same time have an incentive, which has been the basis of the whole thing. And that, I think, is a great, important break in the whole thing. And then in the end, when we were criticizing the cultural environmentalists, I suppose I place myself in that group. I think what people are arguing against is not copyright. It's a number of totally excessive extensions of copyright. I'll use Larry Lessig as an example of that.
Lots of questions here. So two different answers. The first one is that my argument is effectively an ad hominem argument with the people, with first the generation of Martha Woodmansey, Mark Rose, and so on, who have identified Young, and actually Mark Rose is one of the, I think the person who has noticed these organic, he calls them these organicistic metaphors. So actually Mark Rose is the one whose work has been quite important for me, because I don't think it's an organicistic metaphor. It's much more than that. But he's the only one who actually has picked on that thing. So my argument is ad hominem with them and with the cultural environmentalists who endorse the critique of the romantic author. So I'm saying, I'm looking at this, the text that you, meaning Woodmansey, Mark Rose, Jamie Boyle, and so on, have taken to be the moment in which the romantic author was born. And you say that the features of the romantic author is the creation of the flash of genius, this image of human creativity. And say, well, if you actually reread Young, it doesn't say that. It says that genius is a vegetable. So you understand. So my first, the first part of my argument is literally an ad hominem. Like, you say that this is your canonical text, the moment, the place of origin. Well, good luck. If that's your case. So this is the polemical part. The historical part, it is, so first of all, you are right. I really don't think that we have a unified, coherent history of the various models, the various discussions developed in different countries about literary property. I agree with you. From the historical point of view, my story is really like this, it's a bricolage of the English story with the detour to Germany, and it's a story that I effectively take from Rose and Woodmansey. This is pretty much the story that they tell, which does not engage, what's happening in France, for instance. So it is a partial story. I agree with you, but it's partial, but it's not unreliable. For instance, you mentioned the 1774, the Donaldson case. The quote that I read about the face is from the case, right? So it's interesting that also in England, the case that is seen as the final solidification of intellectual of literary property uses an image of creativity that has the same problems of Young's vegetable. It's an image of creativity, of originality, that is on a human body but is not produced by the human body. So it's attached to a human, but it's not an image of human creativity, which to me is the same aporia that we find in Young. So the history is incomplete. I completely agree with you, but I don't think that the incompleteness of the history is a deadly sin.
An incomplete state. I think it's time for our lecture to come to an end. In Canada, we are hoping the current government will stay in power long enough to bring in a new Copyright Act. The Google Book Settlement has bypassed most copyright law as we know it and is causing huge, I think, re-examination of intellectual property. But we've been very privileged this evening to hear a genius speak, to plant ideas, planting ideas in our minds. Some new ideas have grown as we've sat here and listened. And certainly I can see that there are a lot of points for argument and discussion. There will be time for some refreshments outside, and hopefully your ideas will continue to grow. You can decide who's going to own their intellectual property, and I'm sure that we can enjoy each other's company and more discussion. Thank you again for coming this evening.